This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday the 7th of May. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Dean Arcuri. Tonight on the show, we speak to We Are Union Pride, which hit the ground running last week in Melbourne, fighting for LGBTIQA+ rights throughout the Victorian trade union movement. We begin our first in an ongoing series where we explore the realities of a cure for HIV. Are we as close as we hope? Plus, we speak to internationally renowned contemporary artist Spencer Tunick, who's announced that he's coming back to Melbourne to create more art and is asking Australians to once again bear all in a celebration of the body in all its shapes and sizes.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
How close are we to a cure for HIV? While in the Western world, the disease is now manageable, it still hasn't stopped infections from continuing. And every year, we see news articles announcing another big step in a cure. But is it as close as we think? Now on The Informer, Ian Muchamore explores how likely this is to happen in the first of an ongoing series where he will delve into the reality of the science behind finding a cure for HIV.
About 25,000 Australians are living with HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus. Many of us, including myself, have benefited from medical research and antiretroviral drugs that control the virus so it's effectively undetectable and untransmissible. But HIV stubbornly survives and lives, hidden within our bodies. Without the daily antiretrovirals, we would probably become sick and seriously ill within months. The hope and even community expectation for decades has been that HIV would one day be curable. In the last few weeks, I've been exploring how far are we from a cure for HIV? How likely is it to happen? Will there be a eureka moment? How might that happen? What research is underway? And how well do we do at communicating and reporting the latest news about HIV cure work? So I started out at the top, speaking to leading Australian scientist, Professor Sharon Lewin, who leads the Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne.
I think the reporting of cure research is really complex, and it's really complex, and it's when reports come out of we might be, you know, this much closer to a cure, very misleading. You have people in the community that desperately want to have a cure. Finding a cure is really hard, and scientific advances are always exciting, but they don't translate to a cure that will be available very quickly. I'm really passionate about a cure for HIV and have been for over 20 years. And I think the need now is greater than ever. We've got fantastic treatment for HIV, but treatment's lifelong. 80% of people living with HIV are in lower middle income countries who it will be very difficult to fund lifelong treatment for everyone. So I think we need to be investing and planning for a way that we are not tied into treating everyone forever.
When was the moment that you became passionate about an HIV cure?
Well, I started working in this area actually at the very beginnings of antiretroviral therapy in 1997. I was working as a postdoctoral fellow for David Ho in New York City, and David was one of the first people to start combination antiretroviral therapy. Back at that time, when virus disappeared from blood after starting antiretroviral therapy, for a brief time, people thought, ah, we have a cure for HIV, 3 years on treatment, and that will be it. And that's when I started my work in New York, where it was discovered that year in 1998 that 3 years was not going to be enough because of these long-lived silent forms of the virus. Yeah, the scientific process, unfortunately, is filled with highs and lows. You have a good idea, you test it out. It may give you a positive result, it might give you a negative result. Both are really important, and often what gets a lot more press and often what's easier to publish are the positive results. But the negative results are also extremely important, especially if the study is done really well, because it can answer a question and it can stop people from doing the same experiments, which may in turn become negative. This is hotly debated in the scientific literature. It's always difficult to know whether research will be incremental and then slowly lead us to an answer, or whether there'll be a eureka moment that suddenly there's been an absolute transformative discovery. And if you look in areas that have had dramatic changes, they are often linked to a eureka moment. A great example is hepatitis C. We would not have had cures for hepatitis C now without the eureka moment of knowing how to grow hepatitis C in a test tube model, which people couldn't do for years. I think in HIV cure, we've got a really long way to go, and I would love a few eureka moments. In research, though, generally is slow and incremental. And I think we will get advances that will lead us towards a cure, but a dramatic, simple cure for everyone is going to need some major breakthroughs still. Clinical trials are really, really important because we can predict things from laboratory models or animal models of HIV, and then we can be proven very wrong in people. And I think you need both to advance the field. There are loads of clinical trials at the moment of cure interventions for HIV. The last time I looked at this, there would be over 60, 70 studies at the moment internationally in cure research. In Australia, we have many studies, both observational, meaning understanding where the virus is hiding and why, and interventional, giving someone something to change the situation to see if it can be cured. A quick estimate, there may be about 20 observational and interventional clinical trials at the moment across the country. So vitamin D as a cure for HIV, or what we call the VIVA study, is first of all an interventional study. So giving someone an intervention and see whether we've changed things. It is a randomised placebo control study, which is sort of the gold standard or Rolls Royce when you're trying to answer a question whether what you've given is different to a sugar tablet. And the placebo arm is really, really important for a whole range of reasons.
What's the placebo?
Placebo arm is the sugar tablet. Placebo is basically a sugar tablet, and we're making it randomised means that you flip a coin to work out whether someone will get the sugar tablet or the intervention, here being vitamin D. And in the world of clinical research, or in the world where we want the best evidence or the best way to get an answer, a randomised placebo-controlled trial is the gold standard. It's the best way to get the right answer. This study aims to see whether high-dose vitamin D in people living with HIV on effective antiretroviral therapy can reduce the amount of virus that goes into hiding. And we're also going to ask whether it can change other factors that can encourage the virus to go into hiding. The main question, though, is does vitamin D reduce the amount of virus that persists in people on treatment?
Whilst this vitamin D study may or may not lead to a breakthrough moment in HIV cure research, personally, I'm sold that it's another important step along the way, and I've signed up to be one of the first trial participants. I will be reporting soon on what it's like to take part in this clinical trial and following the journey of my blood and biological specimens. But one last question for Sharon. I'm curious, what type of people participate in HIV cure research?
Our participants in cure studies so far, and we've run a number of them here in Melbourne, are generally gay men average age of about 50. That reflects the larger group of patients at the Alfred. Traditionally, people that participate in clinical trials of new antiviral drugs or have often been people that have had HIV for a very long time, and we actually see that in this situation as well. To participate in this study, you have to be on treatment for at least 3 years. But in many of the studies that we've done, the average duration of time on treatment is well above 10 years. So it's often people that have had treatment for a long time. And I suspect it's people that know of how bad things once were for HIV and therefore have remained very committed to see the end of HIV. We do have, however, we also have had participants for whom this is their first clinical trial. So we have had a new generation of participants who haven't participated in other clinical trials before.
That was Ian Muchamore with Professor Sharon Lewin.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Every worker deserves to be safe and secure at work, no matter how they identify. There are so many people fighting for our rights, and that advocacy has expanded in Victoria with the launch of We Are Union Pride, fighting for LGBTIQA plus rights throughout the Victorian trade union movement. But what does that actually mean? What support can this provide? Rachel Tyler-Jones and I find out more as we speak to Amy Jenkins and Rachel Burchard-Burns about We Are Union Pride.
So, Amy, probably the first question that comes up with something like this is that the union's always been an incredible ally to the LGBTIQA community. We work together a lot. What is, from your perspective, the purpose in creating a dedicated, are we calling this a dedicated team?
Yeah, I mean, it's a dedicated campaign, really. I think that it's interesting when we talk about, you know, unions being an ally to the LGBT community, because we're actually just the same thing. You know, LGBTIQ people, we are everywhere. We work in every industry and we're a member of our union. So just as unions have organised around women's issues before, you know, activating and organising the women who have been members of their workplaces, we're now doing that in a more concerted manner with the LGBT community and organising around our issues. Because if we spend, you know, 8 hours of our day at work, your workplace is a huge part of your life, right? And so if we can't eliminate homophobia from workplaces, then you can't eliminate homophobia from, like, most of your daily life.
So do you think this kind of importance and visibility is something that kind of came out of the marriage equality campaign last year? Not at all?
No, we've been working towards this for years. Unions have been organising LGBT workers in like, you know, an expressly, in a concerted manner for since the 90s, but there hasn't been a more coordinated union-wide effort. Sorry, no, that's not correct. There has been, it's just we haven't had the formalised roles to properly put the effort that is really needed into organising, which is what's really exciting, and it's what a peak body should be doing, is kind of value-adding to unions in that way and organising workers beyond individual workplaces in, you know, in a broader union movement-wide campaign. So when I worked at Trades Hall from 2014, we've been doing stuff since then, and there were a lot of people within the union movement saying that we should be doing more. The issue is always, yes, we want to, but do we have the people to do it? And organising, you know, takes people to coordinate it.
So you're completely right. Unions have been doing this work for years and years and years, and we are just happily the newest iteration that happily got some funding. And I think that it's really important for us to have a specific team with a specific portfolio, because we know that LGBTIQA people are a huge part of our movement, because we're a huge part of society and we're everywhere and we work and we sometimes struggle to enter work. And I think that having a very specific team to work with this community, as well as people who have had that lived experience, is really beneficial, so that sometimes that doesn't get lost in the many, many struggles that the movement has at the moment.
So in this first sort of year to 18 months while this is all starting up, is there just a general agenda of awareness and education, or are there particular tasks or achievements that you're hoping to make?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So actually we have quite a specific body of work. So there is an element of education to our work, but it's certainly not our focus. The purpose of our team is to stand up and fight back for LGBTIQA workers' rights at work. And the way that we do that, obviously, because we work for Trades Hall and we are a team with strong union values, is that we feel that the best way for workers to do that is through their unions. So we have a real focus on organising queer workers and activists to join their unions if they aren't already members, and then organise within their unions to get really specific leave clauses in agreement, because that kind of thing makes a really tangible change to someone's work life. And we are more kind of action focused than just talking about the issues. We're obviously going to be doing a lot of talking about the issues because there's a lot of stuff that people don't already know, but then we don't want to leave it there. We want to actually create meaningful change.
Can you just tease that out a little bit, or maybe just give us an example of what you mean by specific leave clauses?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are doing a lot of consultation with the community itself. So the work isn't simply coming out of a team of four people, because that would be quite meaningless. So we're really excited to be able to work with the community. So just as an example, one of the leave clauses that we are looking at is around a paid medical transition leave for trans workers.
Mm-hmm.
And around that being a very specific leave entitlement, because often in workplaces, anecdotally, we've heard that if you need time away to go through the many procedures that are required, even just going to talk to a doctor required in the process of transition, you're expected to take that out of your sick leave, which is just wrong. It's absolutely wrong, because you're not sick and there isn't something to fix. It's just a natural part of your life and something that you need to do. So we feel really strongly that having a specific leave entitlement there is a tangible, meaningful mechanism that will help some workers. But it's also going to go a long way to changing the way that we talk about these things.
Does this open up any new funding pathways for you guys? For example, you know, applying for grants that are LGBTIQA+ specific?
So our funding comes from the Department of Equality, which is Martin Foley's portfolio. So we are delighted to have that particular, I think it's a grant with a fixed term. And in terms of where our funding goes in the future, I couldn't speak to that. That would be a question for my superiors.
And what was the response like at the launch of We Are Union Pride on Friday night?
It was awesome. There were people from every industry. There were a lot of young trans people there as well, which I think was really important to show that we're doing the right thing, and that we all know that we need to, that the work ahead of us beyond marriage equality is even harder and even more important. Winning marriage equality didn't feel like a win for everyone, not necessarily because, because you're anti-marriage, you're kind of a radical queer or whatever, just because it was so exhausting and we won and it just felt like you could finally flop into bed, not like you could, you know. So I think that we need some time to, like, we've had some time to kind of heal and mentally recover from that, but that we need to remember not to leave our trans siblings behind in this, as some would argue that we did in the marriage equality campaign, and that, you know, there's just so much more to do that affects everyone's daily lives and that we haven't won everything yet.
The launch was a fantastic start to the event, but there's more to come, including an event on Ida Hobbit.
So on May 17th this year, coming up in about a week, it's obviously International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia and Transphobia. And We Are Union Pride is holding an event in the evening of the 17th with the NTEU, the National Tertiary Education Union, where we'll be launching a really huge research project that we're undertaking called Pride Chat. And if there's anyone listening who would like to come along, it starts at 6 o'clock on the 17th at the Clyde Hotel, and we would love to have you there.
That was Amy Jenkins and Connor Burchard Burns from We Are Union Pride.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Internationally renowned contemporary artist Spencer Tunick is returning to Melbourne this July to create 2 days of dramatic nude installations as the co-headlining artist in Chapel Street's Provocare Festival of the Arts. The last time Tunic created work in Melbourne was 2001, with his biggest turnout of participants. And now, he's inviting Melburnians, or any Australians, to take part in 2 days of major artistic installation. I spoke with Spencer Tunic about art, how bodies, and the beauty of diversity.
Well, I've always been interested in multiples. I've been a big fan of Robert Smithson's work, and Yayoi Kusama and Carolee Schneeman. So I'm interested in art with the body and with multiples, whether it's with the body or with clay or with trees. I enjoy multiples in art, but I also enjoy just working specifically with the body because I enjoy working with people. My medium has legs. I get to talk to my medium. And so that's one of the reasons I enjoy working on the large groups is because I'm really a people person.
What is it like when you're engaging and interacting with people in this way? Because, you know, you're dealing with people you don't know, whole groups of people that have come together to help be a part of creating this work for you, and they're naked.
Well, I think I deal with the crowd as an individual. I make mistakes. I'm very human. I'm not too much of a dictator, even though I'm asking them to pose nude in slightly chilly weather. But I am sort of become one with the crowd. I've been used to working with crowds since I was a kid. Actually, in high school, I went to New York Military Academy. In fact, it's the same academy, military academy, that Donald Trump graduated from. So one of us fell off the tank and hit our heads. I don't think it was me, but I think I know how to work with a crowd and work with the figure and with the body. I think I've been doing it since I've been, I would say 15. Naked, though. It's my title, Return of the Nude. I asked them if I could call it that. And the reason why I feel not only is it me returning with this social structure of an artwork, but it's also sort of the return of the sort of the purity of the body in art, which is so in this world now through social media, so turned into very much a place of a celebrity or sort of this where the reality is taken away. Although I think social media is very important in opening up people's minds to the body, and I think more people are getting naked for art because of the ability to share their experiences. I also think we need to come back a little and celebrate the body inequality and sort of, you know, I'm not better than you, I'm the same as you, and we're together in a community making an artwork and creating these artworks together.
So you seem to have picked a very cold time to come to Melbourne. I know that's when Provocare is on.
Well, I know how to work very quickly. Years of experience being arrested and chased by police in New York while working. I know how to get the job done. I know how to get my art done. And so I just, when I'm working in Melbourne, I'm just going to think there are police behind me trying to arrest me. So I'll work really quickly. On the other hand, I'll also work with the body in a very quick manner based on knowledge of what the weather will be. And I'll not be doing an early sunrise work where the temperatures will be quite low. There's a big differentiation between, you know, night hours and daytime hours. And so we'll be working in the daytime hours as to keep this a possible project.
You're putting a call out asking for people to come and be involved. What is it that you're looking for?
Well, I'm looking for, you know, this sense of adventure and the competition between cities, who in the large cities, you know, what denizen is more, you know, apt to take a step of, go beyond their limits and take a step of faith to participate in art regardless of the weather and knowing that I'm going to work quickly. We're looking for rock and roll citizens, you know, risk takers, urban adventurers. Well, I'm excited to make new work because of this relationship that was gifted to me in 2001 where people actually came out in huge numbers. I never expected that. I only expected possibly maybe 1,000. I mean, that's a lot when to really think of people naked participating. But to get over 4,000 in Melbourne, it was the only place I had ever reached that number. And I made some beautiful artworks that morning and just met some wonderful people. And I felt that when I was invited and commissioned by the Chapel Street precinct, I wanted to come back and do work, you know, not so much because of, you know, it's another project that's an artistic project, but more so just to get a vibe from the people and see what, you know, to relive what I once experienced. I'll be using different props and different locations and doing 2 days of work with two different sets of two different groups. So one group will be participating one day, the next group the second day, and I'll be using many colors along with the work. So I'm pretty excited. I really don't know what's going to happen, which is a great thing. Usually I know exactly what's going to happen, but this one's a little bit of a mystery still. And so I'm excited. People can just participate by signing up at provocare.com.au/tunic.
That was internationally renowned contemporary artist Spencer Tunick. Tunick's inviting brave Australians to register now to be part of his provocative new work in Melbourne in July. You can find out more at provocare.com.au/tunic.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Dean Arcuri.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.